It's my great pleasure to be sitting down with Esa-Pekka Salonen. He's here in Chicago for 3 weeks, leading and curating a French music festival here at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. It's called Reveries and Passions. And I apologize in advance, Maestro, if I have to look at the clock. I want to make sure we don't go over time. We're sitting here, I think, in between two rehearsals.
Not only that, it's in between two operas.
Two operas.
So we rehearsed Pelléas et Mélisande, and now after this interval, I'm going to start a run-through of L'Enfant et le Sortilège. And I was actually thinking about that this is the first time in my life when I rehearsed two operas in one day.
In one day?
Yeah.
I saw a bunch of children's choir coming in and the musicians coming in. It's definitely a packed house here. This is actually towards the end of a 6 month about exploration of French music you've been doing with the Philharmonia in London, music of Paris and France. Why have you decided to spend all this time on French music, and not only French music, but music inspired by Paris and France?
I have been thinking about this for years, actually. This repertoire has always been very close to my heart, and I have been performing it for decades. But I felt that it would be fascinating to devote an entire season, or in fact, it's going to be a season and a half to this repertoire, and really to get deep inside it and to kind of familiarize myself with the language and the syntax and the all the cultural references and all that. And I must say that despite the fact that I have known these pieces very well for years, I'm becoming more fluent in the musical language of these composers for the sheer proximity. I've been dealing with this music every day now, practically for the last 6 months or so, and it really starts to feel very organic and kind of normal, which is not bad.
It seems clear that you don't like to just dabble with one kind of music. For example, with the Lutosławski, I think you spent the entire centennial year focusing on his music and recording and now all the French music. Is this a way that you've often worked, or a more recent phenomenon of really immersing yourself?
It's something I always wanted to do, but wasn't able to do. Because as we know, if you are a music director of an American orchestra, for instance, you have to do anything between 14 and 18 programs a year, and which automatically means that you cannot focus on one aspect of the repertoire. You have to kind of cover a wide range of styles and composers and so on. And that becomes quite challenging sometimes, because also you do these 14, 16 programs a year, and you cannot repeat anything the following year. So there has to be at least 2 years in between before you can bring something back. Which means that the sheer amount of repertoire that you are doing is vast, and this kind of immersive approach is practically impossible. And I thought, while I was still in Los Angeles, I thought that in my next life, I will work more on projects and schedule things based on the content and the idea rather than the structure of the institution, and so that's what I've been doing now in London for a few years, and I must say that I rather enjoy that sort of approach.
I want to get to some of these big pieces in just a moment, but since you mentioned it, your life after being the music director of the LA Phil, is your life now what you expected it to be when you left? I know you wanted to spend more time composing, and also it sounds like you've been doing a lot of these more immersive programming. Did you end up having the time that you had? Because you still seem very busy.
Yes, I'm busy still. But the balance between traveling and conducting and composing and so-called life seems to be better than before. There have been some surprises on the way. The first and the biggest surprise was that we actually ended up back in LA after four and a half years in London. Mainly for family family reasons, but also I felt that for my composing, it's best to be back in LA where I no longer have a position, and therefore I can be completely under the radar when I'm back home and composing. I'm really kind of not part of the music business at all, and that seems to be a very productive an approach. So currently I'm on a sort of 50-50 balance between composing and conducting, and that's pretty much where I wanted to be, maybe a little less conducting in the future, but something like that.
So you don't sound like you'd want to go back to being music director of a major orchestra, as some would like you to do in another major American city.
Well, I'm very happy with the way my life is at the moment, and it took me many years to shape it. So it would take a lot for me to abandon this this type of life.
Going back to the festival, can you talk a little bit about the Pelléas et Mélisandes and how we haven't heard it performed with this Chicago Symphony before? What makes this such a challenging work? It's been called a conductor's piece of music.
It's an absolutely fascinating piece of music. It's first of all, it's heartbreakingly beautiful. Every note is kind of perfect. Every note is exactly where it should be. Nothing is superfluous. The text is very haunting and very elusive. The most important things are the ones that are not being said, always between the lines. I said to the orchestra in the first rehearsal that, of course, if one thinks of one's own life, I mean real life, of course, most of the most important things in life are being whispered or spoken very quietly. Very rarely do you sort of yell at somebody that I love you or something like that, or would you marry me? These are always messages delivered very quietly, and Pelléas works on like that. The most profound content is usually very quiet and very lyrical and kind of undemonstrative. It's a challenging but also fascinating piece to conduct because of the sort of elasticity of the form and the phrase and the material. This music is always on its way somewhere, and when it reaches the point where it was going to, it changes direction and goes somewhere else, and it really is like a living thing rather than something constructed. So it doesn't behave like a machine. It behaves like a garden, or perhaps a school of fish.
And then you end the festival with the Messiaen. Can you talk a little bit about that piece?
Turangalila is one of the big cult pieces of the post-war canon. It's a wild, far-reaching, crazy, violent, incredibly beautiful, exotic, sensual, everything kind of piece. It's long and it's very difficult, but one of the most exciting and satisfying listening experiences I've ever had in my life. And in fact, it was a big influence in my life when I was in my early teens. I heard it on the radio kind of accidentally once when I came back from school, and my dad had just brought in a new hi-fi system, and I turned it on, and this piece was playing on the radio, and I kind of came in halfway through, and I really stopped everything, and I started to listen to this music, and I thought, wow, if music can sound like this, then to be a composer must be the most fascinating thing on earth. And it was one of those moments that I still remember very clearly, and my astonishment and my enthusiasm and my reaction. And I think that had I not had that experience as a kid, I might not have become a composer, or at least it would have taken me a longer time to decide.
You were at home when you heard this piece?
Yes, I just got home from school. So it was playing on the Finnish radio.
We call that a driveway moment.
yes, in a car culture, yeah. It was, I think, the Helsinki Philharmonic playing it live on the radio or something like that.
Wow, so it's a very significant piece for your life.
It is, absolutely. And also, it's one of the first pieces I recorded for an international label. I recorded this for then CBS Masterworks back in 80-something, when I was in my 20s still. And now I haven't conducted it for maybe 6 or 7 years, but I'm very happy to come back to it, definitely.
A few years ago, you spoke with my late colleague, Andrew Patner, and he asked you about where you compose and how you compose. And at the time, you said that you like to compose in your country house on the Finnish coast and sometimes in London in your composing studio, and that it took a while for you to get used to composing on a computer. And not long after you had that conversation, you were featured in an international Apple iPad Air commercial, which was really well, amazingly produced and also interesting. And so you've come a long way in that respect. But the commercial itself attracted so much attention inside of classical music and outside of classical music. And I think those of us in classical music were so excited about it because it felt like we were breaking out. Is that how you felt, or were you surprised by that reaction?
That was exactly the way I felt also about it. I thought that, okay, it's not that often that a classical composer is being kind of elevated to mainstream in a way that you know, showing composing classical music as kind of normal activity, which, you know, anybody can do. Not like anybody can do, but it's not something totally esoteric, sort of outside society and this and that, but something that, you know, people like you and me may do. And in this profession, use normal consumer electronic products. And I was really astonished by the visibility of this thing, because it was an international campaign. And I happened to be in Italy myself at the time. I was working at La Scala. And it ran on the Italian TV. And all of a sudden, people recognized me on the streets of Milan.
That never happened before.
Well, not. I mean, very rarely. Uh-huh. But all of a sudden, teenage girls were giggling when I turned up, and I kind of felt that some sort of invisible barrier had been demolished by doing this. And I don't think it was a historic moment or it didn't have any kind of sort of profound cultural importance in any other way.
But it was fun.
Yeah, it was like an indication of what we do not being hopelessly esoteric. It became kind of more normal through that campaign, and I think being normal is a good thing. And that's how I always thought classical music should be positioned in society anyway. Something that normal you can normally do. It's like going to see a basketball game or going to see a movie or watching TV. You can go to a concert. That kind of thing. It should be a sort of effortless part of everybody's life. And you know, if I can position myself or any one of my colleagues can position themselves as part of some kind of everyday life sphere, then I think we have made some progress.
At the same time, the commercial, and also in your whole life in terms of programming orchestras and what you like to conduct, that a lot of that has featured newer music, music that is not seen as having popular appeal, adventurous music, and some of your counterparts and many administrators around the world see a challenge of trying to increase audiences, and they program only the same pieces, the standards, over and over again. You've taken a different route in your life and perhaps have seen even more success in reaching out to new audiences.
Well, I think that as species, as humans, we have this curiosity. And I think the curiosity is something that has actually allowed us to develop the way we have to build these societies, to build the technology, to create a culture, to create the arts, and to reach all the way to the moon, to the depths of the oceans. That the driving force is curiosity. And I think we all share that. And also, I happen to believe that, or I know with certainty that I'm not that vastly different from the rest of mankind, and that if there's something that excites me or moves me, there's a very good chance that there'll be several, many other people who share the same kind of experience. So when I program new music, it's not out of duty. It's out of enthusiasm and conviction. So it's based on a pleasure principle rather than some kind of structural idea of a certain percentage of the repertoire having to be new or whatever. I don't think in that way at all. And I think that when the audience feels that this is music that actually matters to me, it's kind of easier for them to approach it because there's somebody who is kind of leading the way. And my experience has been that it's kind of normal. Again, I use this word a lot in this talk, normal, but that's exactly how it should be. I mean, it's like reading a newspaper. Why would you read last week's newspaper if you can read today's newspaper?
Right. Well, and speaking of today, I think we have just enough time to speak about the first program, which you're about to go rehearse, L'Enfant et les Sortilèges of Ravel. Can you talk a little bit about this?
L'Enfant et les Sortilèges is a fantastic piece by any standards, but it's, especially if you know Ravel's music already, but you don't know this piece, you are in for a surprise because it's the other side of Ravel. It's the sort of wacky, crazy, a little risque kind of thing, and it's very funny, so full of vivid imagination and humor and the variety of expression in that piece is just stunning. You know, it goes to the most lyrical, most beautiful moments, and then it goes to a sort of a almost like a horror film type of expression at the end, where a bunch of monsters are kind of crawling out of the forest and starting to speak rather than sing, in a sort of a funny rhythmical kind of speech, and it's a very rich and very entertaining score, I must say.
Well, Esa-Pekka Salonen, thank you very much for speaking with us, especially in between rehearsing two separate operas, and I hope that we get to speak again.
Thank you very much.